So first we're going to hear from Dr. Bill Stook. He is the director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and the Hazardous Substances Research Branch in the NIEHS Division of Extramural Research and Training. Dr. Stook has served as the director of the SRP since its inception in 1986, and he will give a brief introduction to this series. So Dr. Stook, I'd like to turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Danielle. Appreciate it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first session of our Superfund Research Program series on exposure and latent disease risk. I want to start by saying thank you to everyone who will be presenting today in this excellent series, as well as the other series that are going to happen over the next few weeks, and to all of you who have joined the webinar today. This is an outstanding group of presenters with innovative ways of looking at the environment and health. Understanding the health effects of exposures when there is a lag between exposure and the onset of disease is an important issue, especially in the environmental health sciences. In this session, presenters will introduce exposures and latent disease risk, including information about window susceptibility, later life health outcomes, and will set the stage for the other sessions to follow. We are excited to bring together experts to discuss their work in this session as well as the three sessions to come. We are pleased with the interest that this session has attracted, representing a wide variety of environmental professionals from federal and state regulatory agencies to environmental firms and universities. Registration for this session filled up so fast, so if you haven't already done so, I encourage you to register for the upcoming sessions. And as Danielle just mentioned, these will be archived for future use. It is a pleasure to have these leaders in the field on today's webinar and in our subsequent sessions. I hope that this series sparks new interests, new ideas, and helps us build on concepts related to exposures and latent disease risk as we move forward. Again, thank you to the presenters, and I look forward to the presentation today. Stay safe out there. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Stook, for those opening remarks. So our first speaker today is Dr. Rebecca Fry. She is the director of the Institute for Environmental Health Solutions and the Carol Remmer Engel Distinguished Professor in Children's Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Engineering at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Fry also directs the UNC SRP Center. With a particular focus on genomic and epigenomic perturbations, her lab uses toxicogenomic and systems biology approaches to identify key molecular pathways that associate environmental exposure with disease. A current focus in the lab is to study prenatal exposure to various environmental contaminants, including arsenic, cadmium, and perfluorinated chemicals. So Dr. Fry, I'd like to turn it over now to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to speak, and I'm looking forward to presenting some of our research on inorganic arsenic and its impact on later life health. Inorganic arsenic is known as the king of poisons, as the title conveys, and of course this is a play on words, as arsenic has been used as a poison of kings historically. The greatest threat to public health from arsenic originates from contaminated groundwater. This map that I'm showing you highlights areas around the globe that are currently impacted by arsenic contamination, including Argentina, Bangladesh, Chile, China, India, Mexico, and the United States, just to name a few. In addition to contaminated groundwater, other sources of exposure can include crops, eating crops that have been irrigated with contaminated water, and food prepared with contaminated water. One of the worst hit areas for arsenic contamination is in Bangladesh. The story is quite a sad one, stems back to the 1970s when hundreds of thousands of people were dying from cholera and other diarrheal diseases. UNICEF and other international organizations were on a mission to help countries access clean water throughout the developing world. And in an effort to get people to stop drinking the contaminated surface water, they worked with the Bangladeshi government to promote the use of shallow hand-pumped wells. Unfortunately, these wells were contaminated with high levels of arsenic, a result of naturally occurring arsenic aquifers. After arsenic was discovered, the World Bank led an effort to test more than half of the country's wells, and a very wide swath of the wells was found to be contaminated and is thought to impact more than 100 million people. But it's important to be aware that arsenic contamination is an issue in other areas around the world, including the United States. And we have to consider the public health implications of private drinking wells in the United States, as these are a source of drinking water for up to 45 million Americans. And as many of you know, these are unregulated. The data that I'm showing you come from two of the NIEHS-funded Superfund research programs. The data from New England on the left were published by Dartmouth Superfund research program, and the data on the right from North Carolina from UNC Chapel Hill's Superfund research program. And in both cases, naturally occurring arsenic is contaminating private drinking wells, and there's wide variation in the arsenic levels. For example, in the data that we published from North Carolina, we identified arsenic up to 800 parts per billion, or 80 times the EPA and World Health Organization standard. We're concerned about this exposure because arsenic is a potent carcinogen, an established group 1 carcinogen by IARC, with effects to the skin, lung, liver, prostate, kidney, bladder. And it's also associated with non-cancer endpoints. It's associated with neurological disorders, reproductive effects, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. And some of the pioneering studies that influenced my research trajectory were conducted in studies I've highlighted here, some by Mike Waukes' group on the left and Alan Smith's group on the right. Mike Waukes was at the NCI and the NIEHS, and his lab examined the effects of in utero arsenic exposure in mice. His studies were among the first to establish data on the harmful effects of prenatal arsenic exposure. He performed these studies in CD1 mice and highlighted the carcinogenic effects of gestational exposure, where he found that the offspring of dams that had been given sodium arsenite in their drinking water during gestation, the offspring developed hepatocellular carcinomas as well as tumors in the adrenal glands, livers, lung, ovary, and uterus. And the work from Alan Smith's group is shown on the right. This was from a population in Antofagasta, Chile. This region of Chile had extremely high levels of arsenic during a set period of time, and they compared the standardized mortality ratio data from Antofagasta, Chile, to other parts of Chile for individuals who experienced that high level of exposure while they were in utero or in childhood, and you can see that they had increased risk of dying from both cancer and non-cancer endpoints. And so taken together, both of these show through both rodent models and human populations that arsenic really is a model contaminant for those interested in studying the developmental origins of health and disease. Some of the early work from my lab aimed at studying the effects of prenatal arsenic exposure on the health of women and children. To do this, we launched a pregnancy cohort in Gomez Palacio, Mexico, which is called the Biomarkers of Exposure to Arsenic Study, or abbreviated BEAR for short. We recruited 200 pregnant women at the time of delivery and measured arsenic in drinking water and urine. And because of our interest in potential epigenetic effects, We collected DNA, RNA, and protein from cord blood samples, as well as measuring a series of birth outcomes in the population. In terms of their exposure, the population was found to have arsenic at levels that ranged up to 240 parts per billion, or 24 times the EPA standard. We found that more than half of the population was drinking water that exceeded 10 parts per billion, and almost 30% of the pregnant women were exposed to greater than 25 times. In terms of the health outcomes, we also observed that prenatal arsenic exposure, here indicated on the x-axis, by the presence of percent MMAs, or monomethylated arsenicals, in the pregnant women's urine, was associated with lower birth weight in infants. Interestingly, the same trend of an association between prenatal arsenic exposure in humans and lower birth weight has been observed in populations around the world, including Bangladesh, Chile, and parts of the U.S., and I have highlighted some of those studies at the bottom of the slide. So over the years, the investigations in my lab have focused on understanding the role of various components of epigenetic machinery in relation to arsenic toxicity. We've focused on CpG methylation, microRNA expression, how both of these influence mRNA expression levels and protein expression. And for today, I'll highlight our studies that focused on understanding the relationship between prenatal arsenic exposure and CpG methylation. And I won't have time to go into all of the details, but I'm highlighting the study here that folks can reference afterwards if they're interested. This study was, the first author is a UNC toxicology student, Daniel Rojas, and we examined changes in arsenic-associated CpG methylation, assessing for each individual within Bayer 450,000 CpG sites that covered more than 18,000 genes in the genome. And we also compared these with corresponding messenger RNA levels as well as birth outcome levels. And interestingly, when we analyzed these in the context of prenatal arsenic exposure, we found almost 3,000 CpG sites that were associated with arsenic exposure. I believe that one of the powers of this particular study was that we also had messenger RNA levels, and so we could analyze which of those CpG sites was associated with a functional change in gene expression. When we analyzed it in this context, we found 16 genes that displayed an association between methylation and gene expression. And as we've shown in other studies, these genes appear not to be random, but were enriched for, interestingly, transcription factor binding sites, for example, of a transcription factor known as early growth response, EGR, as well as CTCF transcription factors. When we analyzed these genes in the context of the birth outcomes of the population, we also found some interesting associations with 7 of the genes across the genome. And among these 7 genes was this one here that I'm highlighting, KCNQ1, which is a potassium channel-related gene that resides on the short arm of chromosome 11. This is a really interesting area of the genome as it's a hotspot for imprinted genes. You can see each of these genes that are indicated are imprinted genes. And imprinted genes differ from other genes in our bodies as their expression is parents of origin dependent. So in this graphic, you see that the genes are indicated as pink, blue, or black. And here, pink are maternally expressed genes, blue paternally expressed genes, and then the black ones are non-imprinted genes. You may notice or recognize other genes in this area of chromosome 11, H19 and IGF-2, for example, on the left. The other thing that I'm showing you here is that this imprinted gene section of the genome is highly homologous between humans and mice. And in fact, it appears that imprinted genes are susceptible to the environment during pregnancy. So if you look on the left-hand part of this graphic, you see insulin growth factor 2 as another imprinted gene that resides in that same area of chromosome 11. And in terms of relating this back to susceptibility to the environment during pregnancy, here's a paper that highlights the association between prenatal salmon exposure and insulin growth factor 2 methylation later in life. This famine is termed the Dutch hunger winter in 1944 and 45, when food was rationed in the Netherlands. And here the researchers investigated or compared methylation levels of insulin growth factor in the adults who had been prenatally exposed to famine versus their same-sex siblings who did not experience famine in utero. And so this methylation was measured 6 decades after the famine exposure. You can see the in the green, distributed rations or calories per day between December 1944 and June 1945. So extremely low caloric restriction for pregnant women. And the researchers found that insulin growth factor 2 displayed differential methylation, so decreased methylation in individuals who had experienced famine in utero. And these data highlight that gene methylation is likely tied to latent health effects associated with this early life insult. And so coming back to the identified imprinted gene of interest that we identified from the bear cohort, KCNQ1, has also been shown in other studies to be associated with intrauterine growth restriction, as well as metabolic health later in life. One of the things that I didn't mention before, and I should, is that imprinted genes often play a role in fetal growth and fetal size. And that's one of the things that has been shown for KCNQ1 as well. And so really this is, KCNQ1 is a perfect example of a gene that's linked to both early fetal growth and later life health outcomes, and could provide a mechanistic basis for how arsenic is associated with both early and latent life health effects. And so some of this research really helps us to increase the understanding of the complex mechanisms by which arsenic is a developmental chemical, and the identification of critical genes that regulate fetal growth and later life health. Building on the data from this cohort, one of the interesting questions that we're often asked is how epigenetic data might be used to inform the risk assessment process. And I won't have time to go into the details of this study that we published in CRT, but in collaboration with Julia Rager, we addressed this question by using a benchmark dose modeling approach that was applied to the CpG methylation data for KCNQ1 within the bear cohort. We integrated the data on CpG methylation levels of KCNQ1 with the levels of arsenic exposure in the drinking water in the bear cohort, so the levels that the pregnant women were exposed to in the cohort study. And we could calculate the benchmark dose, or the 10% response level, for CpG methylation. So it could calculate the dose at which those effects were happening to the epigenome. And we tied these to an exposure of 86 parts per billion, or we could also calculate the benchmark dose lower bound or the lower confidence limit for the benchmark dose tied to 55 parts per billion. So really incorporating the data from the human cohort on epigenetic modification in the context of benchmark dose modeling. And so as we think about public health, it's important to note that many individuals in our Mexico cohort and many in the U.S. would easily be exposed to these concentrations or higher, really highlighting public health implications of arsenic exposure on the epigenome. So in summary, it's important to not lose sight of the fact that arsenic continues to poison individuals around the globe, including the U.S., that there's increasing evidence of the role of the epigenome in arsenic-induced disease, and value in developing strategies to integrate epigenetics data into the risk assessment framework. And finally, we'd just like to acknowledge the NIEHS for significant funding for my lab and our groups at UNC, Chapel Hill, my lab for all of the research contributions, and Julia Rager for her collaboration on the benchmark dose modeling approach. And I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Fry, for that. And I just want to remind everybody in the audience that you may submit your questions by using the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right-hand corner. So our first question, so the BMDL for the developmental, So the BMDL for the developmental effects is higher, cancer estimates, and some of the other health endpoints. Hold on, let me read that again. I'm trying to, I think I have to try to minimize. Okay, I'm sorry, Rebecca. I need to do this bigger. Okay,
and
there we go.
Danielle, if you click on the question, you should see the whole question.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so let me do that again. So the BMDL for the developmental effects is higher than the cancer. I'm still not quite certain why it's not. Sorry. Yeah, it's... Sarah, would you mind reading out the question until I can get this box figured out?
Sure. Does it look better now? It looks like you explained it. So the BMDLs for the developmental effects is higher than the cancer estimates and some of the other health endpoints. So I think she's asking, is that the case?
Yeah, so just to remember that in this analysis, what we included in the benchmark dose modeling was that specific gene, so KCNQ1, and its methylation in that cohort in Mexico. And so it's the very beginning, the tip of an iceberg, I would say, of how we would want to begin to think about using epigenetics data in the risk assessment framework. And again, what the data would show is not necessarily that that's the concentration at which the developmental effects are observed, but that's the concentration at which in this cohort the methylation of that specific gene was observed. So I think what we would want to do in future studies is, you know, look at other genes. And again, one of the reasons that we focused on KCNQ1 was because of its association with arsenic prenatally, its association with gene expression, so a functional outcome related to the epigenetic modification, as well as its association with birth outcomes in the population. And I think that was a wise strategy. So what we would want to do next, you know, across other larger cohorts would be to choose, you know, to have a selection of genes that were selected in the same way, so associated with the exposure and the outcome, and see where we were beginning to see those epigenetic effects. But yeah, it's a good point that that's higher than the 10 ppb.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm, this is very odd. For some reason, I'm trying to click on the question and it, okay, here we go. So how might this type of information also inform potential medical interventions for affected individuals?
Well, certainly one of the areas that we've been focused on for many years is increasing the awareness of the potential for exposures that are happening prenatally. So thinking about increased awareness from, you know, both pediatricians or obstetricians and those who are working even with women prior to pregnancy. So I think in terms of public health protection and intervention, we really want to be making sure that populations who are at risk for exposure to arsenic and other chemicals, you know, are aware, pregnant women, children, other vulnerable populations. And then also in the context of the biology of the genes that we're identifying, just highlighting this, the fact that you can have differential CpG methylation and how that, you know, other factors that may influence that. We certainly know that there are dietary ways that we can influence some of those same pathways, whether that's through folate and other methyl donors, that, again, we could begin to think about those as ways to intervene.
Okay, thank you. So the next question, and I'm assuming, well, I'll just... based on your answer to the last question, but I actually think it was probably the question before, what are you defining as an effect in the LOEL, L-O-E-L?
So for the benchmark dose approach, we're using a 10% change in methylation levels, and then the benchmark dose lower bound is a confidence interval separation between the benchmark dose.
Okay.
So again, some of those modeling approaches have only been done in the context of, and not very often, but only done in the context of gene expression. Rusty Thomas has really pioneered some of that work in using gene expression in the benchmark dose modeling approaches. And so we've modeled our data, the epigenetic data, the methylation, in the same way.
Okay, thanks, Rebecca. So the next one that came in is, arsenic has 5 speciated ions. Is there a way to understand which arsenic species is affecting?
Well, the way that we've done this is to measure, we've measured arsenic in water. We've also measured arsenic and its species in urine. So actually one of those findings was that increased levels of the monomethylated form of arsenic in urine was associated with lower birth weight. And those can give us a pretty good indication of which of the arsenic species is, you know, associated with the outcome.
Okay. The next one is, if cultured human cells are exposed to arsenic, does gene imprinting occur?
Yes, we have some data from our lab where, you know, we're focusing on the placenta as the target tissue because of our interest in developmental toxicity of arsenic. And that work has been published by Cassie Meekin in the lab. And Cassie showed that gene expression changes in placental cells that have been exposed to arsenic, and that expression is tied to CpG methylation. So yes, we can recapitulate what we see in, you know, the CpG methylation effects in cell culture, in placental cell culture exposed to arsenic.
Okay, that's very interesting. The next one is, are you seeing sexual dimorphism in the adverse birth outcomes associated with the altered methylation due to arsenic?
We didn't hear, but it's a great point. In several cohorts, there have been the outcomes that are observed in relation to arsenic exposure do show a sexually dimorphic effect. We didn't see it here. We did see, we have one of the papers that we've published from the Bayer cohort where we focused on a proteomic assessment, so following this sort of biological downstream after gene expression and then looking at protein expression, there we saw that protein expression was displayed a sex-dependent response. So it was different if we were examining protein expression in males or females. Yeah, a really interesting point, something we're really fascinated with.
Okay. Next one is monomethyl arsenic in urine is an indicator of exposure to inorganic arsenic since it is a primary metabolite of inorganic arsenic. I think this is meant just to be more of a comment, but do you have a response to that?
Yeah, so when we're exposed to arsenic, arsenic is methylated in the body and converted into monomethylated and then dimethylated forms. And so you can measure these different proportions of inorganic arsenic, monomethylated arsenicals, and dimethylated arsenicals in urine. And that can give you an indication of how well generally is thought, how well someone is metabolizing arsenic. And so in this case, and actually many cases in arsenic exposed populations, when monomethylated forms of arsenic are high, it's often associated with increased risk for the detrimental health outcomes. And the case which is opposite that is actually in the case of diabetes. But for most cancer endpoints, elevated levels of the monomethylated forms are associated with increased disease risk.
Okay, well, thanks, Rebecca. I think we're going to go ahead and go on to the next presentation. But I definitely still encourage everybody to continue to ask questions to Dr. Fry. And if you could, if you have more questions for her, please put her name in the Q&A pod so I know when we go back that question was intended for her. Thank you again. So next we're going to hear from Dr. Heather Stapleton and Dr. Seth Coleman. So Dr. Stapleton is an environmental chemist and exposure scientist at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. She currently serves as deputy director for the Duke SRP Center and the director of the Duke Environmental Analysis Laboratory. Her research interests focus on identifying halogenated chemicals in consumer products and evaluating human exposure to these chemicals, particularly in pregnant women and children. Dr. Seth Coleman, he is a professor of toxicology in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University. He leads a project as part of the NC State SRP Center and is a co-investigator on Dr. Stapleton's project at the Duke SRP Center. Coleman has a longstanding history of utilizing small aquarium fish models in mechanistic toxicity studies with an emphasis on developmental biology, endocrine biology, and metabolic disruption. So their full bios are available on the registration page for this webinar. So Dr. Stapleton and Dr. Coleman, I'm going to turn it both over to you.
Great. Thank you. I'm on the Adobe, but I don't seem to see the arrows so I can advance the slides. Could you turn the over control to me?
Yeah, it looks like maybe you dropped off and came back on, so I am adding it back to you. You should see them
now. Okay, great. I see them now, yes. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for providing the opportunity for Dr. Coleman and I to speak today. So Seth and I together are going to be talking for the next 20 minutes about some of the ongoing work at the Duke University Superfund Research Center. Together, Seth and I direct Project 2, which focuses on the impacts of flame retardants and plasticizers on inducing adipogenesis and looking at this kind of critical pivot between adipogenesis and osteogenesis and understanding the potential impacts on metabolic disorders. So we already talked about this, and I think you saw this slide or this figure in Rebecca's presentation earlier. The Superfund Research Center at Duke University focuses on DOHAD, and our theme is early life exposures, later life effects. So very fitting for this webinar today. We're really interested in understanding how these perinatal and early life exposures to a variety of different hazardous chemicals impacts growth and development and later life effects. And in particular, we're interested in things like neurodevelopmental disease, But our project focuses a lot, or historically has focused on impacts on fire regulation, but we've now moved into adipogenesis and osteogenesis. And we are interested, as I said, in flame retardants, but it's important to recognize that, you know, we live in a very big world with lots of different chemicals. So while we focus on a few sets of chemicals, we're slowly trying to expand our scope to focus in on environmental mixtures. And I think many of you have probably seen the New Scientist magazine cover, which came out, I think it was back in 2014. You know, we've made 150,000 new chemicals, but which ones should we worry about? And this is something I think a lot about, and I think our Superfund Center focuses a lot on, that we recognize the importance of focusing on individual chemicals to understand their impacts, but trying to take that to further and evolve to focus on the importance of mixtures. And so the research questions that we're hoping to briefly talk about today, and which we're focusing on in Project 2, are understanding how halogenated and organophosphate-based organic contaminants affect thyroid hormone regulation, particularly as it might relate to thyroid disease, adipogenesis, and osteogenesis. So this includes things like halogenated aromatic compounds. I know Seth's going to talk a little bit about dioxins. My research has focused a lot on brominated flame retardants, particularly PBDEs, which look or have a chemical structure that's very similar to thyroid hormones. But as PBDEs were phased out, they were readily replaced with a number of different types of organophosphate ester flame retardants. And we have some evidence to suggest exposure to those compounds has increased over the last decade. And there's an intricate balance between adipogenesis and osteogenesis, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. And then, as I said, talk a little bit also about exposure to environmentally relevant mixtures, and in particular, chemical mixtures that are present in house dust to which we are chronically exposed every day, and understanding how exposure to these mixtures might impact these specific pathways. So today I'm going to talk about some results from these in vitro experiments we've been conducting over the past several years, which are evaluating the impact of both chemicals and mixtures on adipogenesis, and specifically the accumulation of triglycerides. So we use 3T3L1 cells for these experiments. So these are mouse fibroblasts pre-adipocytes. So they're already on the line or on the pathway to develop into adipocytes. So this is a cell culture experiment where we're measuring both the accumulation of triglycerides in cells and understanding how the cells proliferate. So we have two different assays that we measure and which will be in some of the subsequent slides. So to measure triglyceride accumulation, we use Nile Red, which is a dye. So as the cells proliferate, grow, and produce triglycerides, we can add this dye and then highlight the lipid droplets in the cells, which can be quantified on a plate reader. And at the same time, it's also important to understand how the cells proliferate and grow and the number of cells present, because you can have more triglycerides due to greater triglycerides per cell or just having more cells. So both of these are equally important in understanding the impacts and measurements. So we use the nucleoDNA dye to measure cytotoxicity and proliferation. So it partitions, the blue dye partitions into the nuclei and fluoresces upon binding to the DNA. And so you can see here, actually, this is just a microscopic view of these cells. And you can see this golden yellow color is reflective of the triglyceride accumulation accumulating in these cells. And in this case, this is a result of exposure to rosiglitazone, which is a well-established PPAR-gamma agonist. So a lot of the work we've been conducting over the past few years has really been led by my postdoc, Chris Casota, and he's been running these experiments, and we have a couple papers that have been published. And so we started these series of experiments by trying to understand the impact of specific flame retardants on adipogenesis and cell proliferation in these 3T3L1 cells. So what you're looking at in this figure is on the left, and I'm going to use my arrow here. Oops. So here on the left, you're looking at the triglyceride accumulation per cell with increasing concentrations of these various brominated flame retardants in the top panel. And on the bottom panel, we're looking at organophosphate-based flame retardants. Although I will point out that some of these organophosphate esters are also used heavily as plasticizers and not necessarily as flame retardants. And then on the y-axis over here, this is normalized triglyceride accumulation per cell. And then on the right is cell proliferation or cytotoxicity. So if we focus on this panel here in the upper left-hand corner, you can see that with increasing concentration of these individual flame retardants, we see increasing accumulation of triglyceride in these cells. And the stars indicate statistical significance. So for example, 1 micromolar of TBPH, which is a brominated phthalate. It's basically the brominated analog of diethylhexyl phthalate. We had statistical increase in triglyceride accumulation. TBPH and TBB are both brominated flame retardants. They're in a mixture called Firemaster 550, which Seth will be talking about in his slides. And so they've been around for a while, though exposure to these compounds has increased over the last decade as well. But then if we look at cell proliferation and cytotoxicity, we see that in majority of these, there's no change from zero, nothing statistically significant with the exception of TBPH, where we're noticing some proliferation of the cells. So more cells are there, but no evidence of cytotoxicity over any of these doses that have been tested. And then if we look at organophosphate flame retardants on the bottom panel, you can see that around 1 micromolar, we have several of these organophosphates, which are leading to a statistically significant increase in triglyceride accumulation. And please note that this scale here is very different than the scale above, where for brominated flame retardants, it only went up to 50%. But down here with the organophosphates, it's going up to 200%. So particularly at 1 micromolar and 10 micromolars, we had pronounced accumulation of triglycerides normalized to each cell. And this was more significant for 2 non-halogenated flame retardants. ITPs were one of them, that's isopropylated triaryl phosphates. So these are basically triphenylphosphate with methyl groups on them, or excuse me, isopropyl groups on them. And TBPDP, these are difficult acronyms, I know, which that stands for tert-butylphenyl diphenylphosphate. Both of these are alternative flame retardants that have been increasing in use over the past decade. And you can see they are definitely more potent than some of the brominated flame retardants. And again, we saw no cytotoxicity and a sudden suggestion for proliferation at like 10 micromolars, but it was fairly minimal. So these flame retardants are very common in household dust. Our group has been examining exposure to flame retardants for almost 2 decades now, and we know that these flame retardants can leach off of consumer products and accumulate in house dust, and we know that house dust is an exposure pathway, particularly for children. We've been interested in understanding what these mixtures that are present in dust, whether or not they could also induce adipogenesis. So we had a study where we collected paired samples of blood and dust from approximately 140 individuals living in central North Carolina. These samples were analyzed for a specific suite of flame retardants, but what we also did with this set of dust samples is run them on this adipogenesis assay. We were really interested in understanding whether environmentally relevant exposures to dust could induce adipogenesis. And so if we go over here to the left, my mouse here. I think I lost my mouse somehow. Oh, there it is. So on the upper left here, you can see each line represents a different dust sample, which we ran on the assay using a dose response curve. And you can see, hopefully you can see it on the x-axis, this is the dust extract concentration. So it's the mass of dust per well. This is in micrograms per well. And you have triglyceride accumulation per cell on the y-axis. So you can see that some of these dust samples, particularly around 100 micrograms per well, induce significant triglyceride accumulation. And it's important to note that this is a very environmentally relevant level. The EPA estimates that children receive an exposure to house dust about 50 milligrams per day. So these are micrograms per well, so well within environmentally relevant doses. And we did observe significant activity. And in this case, on the right, if you looked at the cytotoxicity, there was no proliferation and not very much cytotoxicity. So this would be a phenotype we would characterize as high triglyceride accumulation and minimal pre-adipocyte proliferation. And then we had some dust samples that had a very different, what I'll call phenotype. On the bottom here, there's some dust samples that exhibited no triglyceride accumulation whatsoever over similar dose ranges, but did observe or did lead to proliferation of some of the cells. so increase the number of cells in the cell culture. So they had a very different phenotype. So we're interested in kind of using these different phenotypes we observe in the dust samples and explore how they might relate to certain health outcomes in these populations. So one of the statistical analyses that we ran with this data set is a robust regression where we controlled for sex, age, race, and education to try to understand how adipogenesis or triglyceride accumulation in the dust samples correlated with, in this case, we looked at the BMI of individuals living in these homes where the dust was collected. It is important to note that a requirement for the inclusion in this human subject study was that the individual lived in the house for a minimum of 2 years. Since we are interested in these connections between house dust and biological measures, it was important that we ensure that the individuals had lived in these homes for a minimal amount of time. So our minimum for inclusion was 2 years, but we were fortunate that the participants in this case had lived in their house for on average 10 years. So that provides us more certainty that what's in the dust really does mimic kind of more longer term exposures over time. So when we ran these analysis, we found that the triglyceride accumulation in cells following exposure to this dust was significantly associated with the BMI of the individuals living in the home. So you can see the graph on the left, and we interpret this basically it finds that with every 10% increase in adipogenic activity in the dust samples, there was a, on average, a 0.3 increase in BMI in kilograms per meter squared, which was statistically significant, whereas we did not see a statistically significant association with cell proliferation or just total triglycerides. So normalized triglycerides means the triglyceride accumulation normalized to the number of cells, which is more relevant. So that was really interesting to us. So it is a relatively small sample size, it's 140, but these individuals did live in the home for some time, as I mentioned. We have tried to repeat this in a more current cohort with children. We had approximately 180 children we recruited recently from Central North Carolina as well, and ran a similar analysis where we did not observe this association, but in this latter case with the children, these children had not lived in the home very long. Majority of the, so we had a very wide demographic background for our participants, and many of them moved homes frequently. So in some cases, the children had only been living in these homes for a month or so before we collected the dust samples. So there's more difficulties and nuances in looking at that relationship. So we're interested in kind of looking at this again in the future. Another interesting endpoint in these cells, so these are ZenBio 3T3L1 cells. They've been used by a number of researchers. They do express various nuclear receptors, and many nuclear receptors can be involved in adipogenesis. And so in this case, we took these ZenBio cells and exposed them to established positive controls for different nuclear receptors, rosiglitazone for PPAR-gamma, you can see GW3965 for LXR, dexamethasone for GR, et cetera. And as we would expect, some of these nuclear receptors certainly led to increased triglyceride accumulation. But what was really interesting to us was the increase in triglyceride accumulation with exposure to I850, which is a thyroid receptor antagonist, not an agonist, but an antagonist. And we have a large interest in thyroid hormone regulation and how some of these chemicals interfere with thyroid hormone regulation. And because we had an assay to measure TR antagonism, we actually measured TR antagonism in these dust samples. And we noticed that triglyceride accumulation, so the activity of triglyceride accumulation, was significantly correlated with TR beta antagonism in the same dust extracts, with a Spearman correlation, if I look over here, of 0.447, that was statistically significant. And that was not correlated with proliferation, just triglyceride accumulation. So this increased our interest in understanding which nuclear receptors were involved in the triglyceride accumulation we are observing in these environmentally relevant mixtures. So to understand this a little bit more, Chris, the postdoc, ran a few interesting experiments. So we had hypothesized that antagonism of TR-beta was playing a strong role in the adipogenesis and accumulation of triglycerides we were observing in these dust samples. So he ran two different experiments. In the first experiment, on the top panel over here, we have 9 random dust samples we pulled from this cohort I've been talking about. And what we did was we actually incubated them with and without T3, so T3 being the hormone, thyroid hormone, triiodothyronine. And our hypothesis was that if TR and beta antagonism was playing a role, we would expect to see a decrease in triglyceride accumulation. And we did, in fact, observe this in almost all dust samples we tested, with the exception of this one sample here, where there appeared to be an increase, actually, and then in this last dust sample, where there's no difference with and without incubation of T3. But 7 of these 9 did result in a decrease in triglyceride accumulation upon co-incubation with the natural thyroid hormone T3, which was interesting. And then to follow it up, Chris performed an experiment where he basically knocked down TR alpha and beta using siRNA. And so you can see, again, 9 dust samples here. The first is without any co-incubation, so just the dust sample. The second is a positive control for siRNA without the TR knockdown. And then the third colored bar would be the TR knockdown. And so, again, you can see in almost all cases there is a knockdown of triglyceride accumulation when we actually knock down TR alpha and beta. So this just provides evidence to us that antagonism of thyroid nuclear receptor beta is an important mechanism in this, this triglyceride accumulation that we observed in these dust samples. And as I said, so this we've been doing a lot of work on thyroid hormone regulation as well. And one of the assays that we also have in our lab is this gene blazer assay that measures antagonism of TR beta. And so this uses a Gal4 ligand binding domain to examine, but you can use it for both agonism and antagonism. Basically, we've been using this with house dust extracts as well. So we extract all the chemicals out of house dust, putting up here, using organic solvents. We remove the organic solvents and put them into DMSO and then run them on this assay. And in this case, we also analyzed the dust samples for a number of different flame retardants as well. But what was interesting is that, like the triglyceride accumulation, on the left panel here, you're looking at TR-beta inhibition on the y-axis and the dust extract concentration on the x-axis. So again, these are in micrograms per mil. As I said, dust EPA estimates that children ingest 50 milligrams of dust per day, so again, environmentally relevant. So each colored line represents a different dust sample. You can see some dust samples had no TR beta inhibition over this range, and some had very nice dose response relationships and up to about 60% inhibition. And when we took this data, we can then, using the dose response line, calculate the potency of each dust sample. So on the right, you can see the relationship between the potency of each dust sample for antagonism of TR beta associated or correlated with the serum-free T4 concentrations of the participants living in this home. And here we found a negative, statistically significant association between the TR-beta antagonism of the dust sample and free T4. So samples that were more potent would be over here on the left, right? So smaller concentrations are inducing a more potent effect on TR-beta antagonism, leading to a higher free T4 concentration. So this is almost what I'd think of as like a hyperthyroidism phenotype. And you can see that some of these are circles and some of these are squares. Circles were measurements made from these dose response curves over here. We had a few samples, which are the squares, where we couldn't get a full dose response. The highest measurement we made had a slight activity in TR-beta inhibition that was almost reaching the 20% threshold, but we actually had to extrapolate above that to get a point, so that's what these squares are. But these all together were statistically significant, and if we even just focus in on the circles, it's even more significant. So together, again, it suggests that there are these mixtures present in house dust that may be associated with certain metabolic disorders, things like thyroid hormone dysregulation and other endpoints. And so this is something we will continue to focus on in our Superfund Center. But what about osteogenesis? So I'm going to stop talking now and turn it over to Seth so he can talk a little bit about osteogenesis. Seth?
Yep, I'm here. Thanks, Heather. I appreciate it. Okay, so what we're going to find is that the adipogenesis and the osteogenesis are really just two sides of the same coin. So, and that will become more evident in a couple of slides. And so one of the things that my lab is really interested in focusing on is how these types of compounds, these brominated and non-brominated flame retardants, are disrupting bone development and maybe contributing to adult degenerative bone diseases. I use this slide here to sort of give just sort of a primer on the fact that the rate of bone accrual happens pretty early in age here in boys and girls between 12 and 14 years old. And this is the peak rate of bone accrual. Now, this is not the total amount of bone that is acquired, but it's the rate at which it's acquired. So kind of giving us sort of this idea that early developmental perturbations to bone development may have impacts later in life. Okay. And so let me see if I can get my slides changed here. All right, so you know, one of the experimental questions then is, can environmental exposures contribute to different types of osteochondral dysplasias and or degenerative diseases that we're working with? All right, so as Heather mentioned, one of the compounds that we've been working with quite a bit is dioxin, and I'm just using this as an example, as these studies are a little bit more further along in our lab than the flame retardant work, but we use two different models. We use a zebrafish and a Madaka models. These are both small aquarium fish models that we think are good translational models. They've got some features that really allow us to visualize early osteogenesis and osteochondral phenotypes that are occurring and enable us to give a large number of animals early embryonic exposures or exposures through various different life stages. So what I'm illustrating in this slide here is basically two different types of visualization techniques. The first is just an alizarin complexone, which is a fluorescent live stain. We can just simply soak these animals in this fluorescent stain and then image them live. But we're also working with a number of various transgenic lines, which is also a bonus that we get to work with these particular aquatic models, where we can follow particular subtypes of cells that contribute to the development and the mineralization of bony features in these animals. And so what I have here are three panels. We've got fish that were exposed early and during development, about 4 hours post-fertilization, and for an approximately 4 hour exposure. Now, dioxin is super lipophilic. It will accumulate in the lipid droplets and the lipid of these embryos and stay with these organisms for a long time of period. So we don't really need a very long exposure, but we get an extended exposure because of its lipophilicity. Here we looked at these animals at about 20 days post-fertilization after this 1 hour exposure. So you can see our DMSO, our 0.15 nanomolar TCDD, and a 0.3 nanomolar TCDD. And if you just look along this top panel here, so if I can pull up my arrow, it's not showing up here. Let's try it again. There it is. If you look at the arrow, these features are called centra in the fish, hemal or neural and hemal arches. This is equivalent to what you might consider a vertebrae and some ribs. And you can see with DMSO at about 20 days, we have nice mineralization. The alizarin complexone measures calcium deposition. And by simply adding dioxin, we start to lose the structure of the centra. We start to lose the formation of the hemal and neural arches. And we really, with a higher dose, we begin to really lose calcification and formation of these centra. In the middle panel here is the GFP expression of some mesenchymal stem cells, right? This is a twist EGFP. And these cells give rise to the cells that form the calcification and the mineralization of the centra. They move from the intervertebral space here in the center out towards the periphery in the center of the centra, and they turn into a set of cells that deposit calcium. As you can see, as we give dioxin, the distribution and the packing of these cells becomes quite loose and aberrant, and in conjunction, we start losing mineralization and formation of these centra. Okay, when you do the overlay, you get a nice picture here, and what I want to do is move down to the right-hand panel, the bottom right-hand panel, and show you some arrows. Well, basically, we're showing that the mesenchymal stem cells are actually migrating into the centra, but they're not turning into the type of cells that are forming the calcium deposition in these cells because they're still green. As long as they're green, they're mesenchymal in their form, in their phenotype. All right. So let me get to the next slide here. So the next thing that we do is we sort of look at whether these can recapitulate different skeletal diseases. This is just simply an RNA-seq data set. We've gone through and run the RNA-seq data set. As you can see in the rear panel, we can recapitulate a number of diseases associated with mineralization and ossification, arthropathy and arthritis. And then if you look more on a disease basis, we're picking up a number of diseases basically in osteogenesis imperfecta, different skeletal dysplasias, and an EDS syndrome. So we asked the question then for in vivo studies, do we see a similar type of phenotype when we move to the flame retardants? So here we've used FireMaster 550, and as Heather had mentioned, triphenylphosphate, which is a primary component into the FM 550 mixture. We're using the same animal. On the left-hand panel here, you can see the formation of the tail of these organisms. Seems to be a very sensitive region of development. And you can see the last few centra and vertebrae forming, and then these structures here are called lepidotrachea. These are the fin rays, but they are bony and cartilaginous structures. We also have a number of cartilaginous structures here. Again, these are called hypural structures, and these form the foundation for the lepidotrachea. If you slide over here, we've got a 20 micromolar FireMaster 550 exposure and a 0.75 micromolar TPP exposure. You can see that we have drastically reduced formation of these centra, decreased calcium deposition, poor formation of various cartilaginous structures, and then fused lepidotrachea. They don't seem to have these other junctions with the cartilage in here, indicating that FireMaster and TPP can produce some rather profound phenotypes in these animals. Again, here, normal animals with our twist. I apologize for these images being a little grainy, but nice packing of the mesenchymal stem cells in the intervertebral space, good formation of the centra again, but then following TPP and FireMaster 550, again, poor formation of hemo and neural arches, centra formation, loosely packed mesenchymal stem cells again, and then movement of those mesenchymal stem cells back into the centra, similar to the phenotype that we saw with TCDD. So the fact that we have a strong phenotype with these mesenchymal stem cells led us to the idea that maybe we should be looking at some of these types of cells to see if these kinds of compounds basically cause a disruption in these abilities of these cells to differentiate into osteoblasts. Now, just a little primer on this is that these are multipotent cells. They can go to muscle, they can go to bone, they can go to fat, they can go to cartilage, a number of lineages. And so we started off working with a number of human donors that we received from some folks at UNC, and we exposed these human donors to osteogenic media to get them to differentiate. And the cells would differentiate by about 14 to 21 days, producing a fair amount of calcium deposition in the plates, again stained with alizarin red stain here. And that you can see in the formation or lack of formation of the calcium deposits in the presence of about 10 nanomole TCDD. We followed these studies up in the right-hand corner here, looking at calcium deposition and following inorganic phosphate deposition, and you can see that there's reduced calcium and phosphate deposition there as well. What was interesting here is that previously we've been able to show, and others have been able to show, that often what you get is a metabolic switch when you expose these cells to different types of compounds. So if you don't have osteogenesis, often you would push adipogenesis, or if you don't have adipogenesis, you may push chondrogenesis or osteogenesis. In this case, we looked at most different differentiation phenotypes, and here we were able to indicate that dioxin at 10 nanomolar does not cause these cells any adipocytes or any increase in fat formation, even with the loss of osteogenesis. We took this step a little bit further. We did a time series trying to identify some of the molecular events associated with what was happening here. In the right-hand panel, you can see that essentially we have a number of markers that are occurring over time that are impacting osteogenesis. And a number of markers that are also looking at different types of extracellular matrix events. When we drilled down a little bit further, we found a very significant correlation with disruption in Wnt signaling. While there were some Wnt ligands that came up, we have a very strong signal of Wnt inhibitors came up, Wnt being a very primary upstream signal for driving osteogenesis as well as differentiation of these cells into other lineages. One piece of information that was really interesting to us is that when we looked at the difference between just growth media, media that had been cells that have been differentiated in the presence of osteogenic media or osteogenic media in the presence of dioxin and start looking at stem cell markers, we were basically able to show that in the presence of osteogenic media, we would take those stem cell markers, SOX2, OCT4, and NANOG down, but when we gave them dioxin, those markers came back up. Now, this is a chicken and the egg question. We don't know if these markers are back up because these cells aren't differentiating, or if these cells aren't differentiating because these markers are back up, and that's something we're kind of looking at a little bit further. So again, to flip back to what's happening with the flame retardants, we asked the question, does TPP attenuate osteogenesis in this model? And while our effects were not as profound as they were with the dioxin, we saw definitely a decrease at the 10 micromolar concentration with these particular cells. So then the next thing to ask was, well, what about adipogenesis? And unlike the results with dioxin, we basically have been able to show that while we see a decrease in osteogenesis, under the same conditions, under pushing these cells towards an osteogenic phenotype, we actually begin to produce adipocytes. Right? Now, this has been identified before by Jim Schlesinger's group and Heather's group in mice, but this is the first time we've been able to see it in human cells, basically indicating that under osteogenic conditions, we give them TPP and we can reduce osteogenesis and then switch these cells and have them begin to form adipocytes. This is enhanced by insulin. This is Jen's protocol for working with these cells. She uses insulin. Insulin helps package these lipids into these lipogenic packets. And so we were able to show that insulin is promoting this effect with TPP. All right, so what do we think is happening? We know with these mesenchymal stem cells, there's a number of compounds that you can add to help facilitate bone formation, bisphosphonates, vitamin D, signals with BMPs. We know that there's a number of compounds that will push them to adipose, organotins, rosiglitazone, as Heather has shown, simple aging. With dioxin, what was interesting is that we were able to show that these cells inhibit both bone formation and adipose. So we suggest that we're seeing sort of a disruption or an inhibition of early differentiation and or commitment of these cells. With FireMaster and TPP, we emulate more of what we see with organotins and rosiglitazone in aging, and that is where we begin to inhibit bone, but we then begin to push adipose. So with that, just a few comments. We think that the developmental exposures of flame retardant can significantly disrupt bone, cartilage, and maybe other lineages associated with mesenchymal stem cell development. That the phenotypes in these small aquarium fish models can really serve as excellent linkages between phenotypic and molecular approaches for skeletal diseases, and that flame retardants potentially impact these lineage progression of these mesenchymal stem cells through various mechanisms. And as is, we're looking for different types of NRs or NR other types of proteins, and we've been working with a company called Collaboration Pharmaceuticals, Inc. that have been doing a lot of modeling for us. So with that, let's see here. We've got a number of folks to thank in our lab. Atlee Watson did all the TCDD work. Stacy Skoda did the flame retardant work. Chris has also been working in our lab on his K99 award. And a few other folks, Megan, Melissa, and Morgan, for working with our fish models. And then Sean with Collaborations, Inc. And then Heather's got a group of folks in her lab that she might want to acknowledge as well.
Well, I think since we're over time. Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. Yeah. I just know we're running over. So I think we'll stop there and we can probably ask questions if there are questions.
Okay. Thank you, Heather and Seth. That was a really very nice duo presentation. I think we have time for maybe one, if not maybe just two quick questions. I think this could probably either one of you could answer this, but In your cell culture experiments, do the dust mixtures enter the cell, or I guess maybe even in the in vivo system, and is it possible that the differential results between the different mixtures may also have something to do with the variability of the particle sizes between the different mixtures?
I think that one's yours, Heather.
Sure, I'll tackle that one. I think the last one was about different particle sizes. I probably should mention all these dust samples were sieved to less than 100 microns for before extraction. So we do take care to make sure they're all the same particle size, and we just extract out the chemicals from that size fraction of the particles, which are more relevant for human exposure anyway. And then I think the first part of the question about do the chemicals get into the cells, and yes, we're fairly confident they get into the cells. It's just impossible to differentiate whether they're adsorbed to the outside or how much actually gets inside the cell. We're not able to examine that right now, but we know they're not, you know, there's not as much in the media left because we measure what's in the media versus what's likely in the cells. So, yeah, we do think they're getting out. We just can't differentiate between adsorption and absorption at this point.
Okay, and one more question. So what other environmental factors were controlled or during the analysis of BMI and triglycerides and dust samples?
Sure, I think that one went to me. The paper is published. We did control for age, sex, education. We didn't have income. We used education as a surrogate for SES. And there might have been one other thing that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head, but there are three or four covariates in the model, certainly. And they can be found in the paper that's published in Science of the Total Environment.
Okay, well, thank you very much again to Heather and Seth. Really appreciate it. And so now we're going to turn over to our next presentation. So next we're going to hear from Dr. Brian Barrich. He serves as the scientific director of the NIEHS division of the National Toxicology Program. As the scientific director, he provides policy, analytical, and scientific leadership to the DNTP, as well as planning, managing, and coordinating its internal and external activities. In addition, in a dual role as associate director of the National Toxicology Program, he manages day-to-day operations and fosters interactions with other federal agencies on NTP activities. He joined the NIH back in January of 2018, and previous to NIEHS, Dr. Barrich spent 17 years in the pharmaceutical industry in varying roles as a toxicologic pathologist at Eli Lilly in Indianapolis, Indiana, and at GlaxoSmithKline in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. And again, a full bio for him is available on the session registration page. So now, Dr. Barrich, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Danielle. So by virtue of that introduction that Danielle just gave you, it should be very clear that I'm not an expert in anything that we do in the DNTP, but have the great opportunity to represent a lot of the great things that we do within the organization. And I appreciate that opportunity. The invitation that I had seemed pretty straightforward on the front end, which was to represent how we consider latent hazards at DNTP. And I have to admit that the more I dug into this, the more complex the subject became, particularly in the context of the kinds of things that we do and are trying to get a fundamental understanding about how to model and ultimately even predict latent hazards. And so a lot of this made my head hurt. So I've tried to pull together some things that to represent how latent hazards are considered in the context of what we do. I won't be digging into any individual or specific agent, although there will be different kinds of agents that will be scattered throughout this presentation. So hopefully I'll be able to give you a little bit of insight into how we integrate the challenges of latent hazards in the way the DNTP operates. So I'll just give you a brief introduction into the DNTP and the National Toxicology Program, because I think that context is important for considering why we approach it the way that we approach it. A little bit about latency as a concept or a principle, and then talk a little bit more specifically about latency in the context of our developmental and reproduction studies, our carcinogenicity studies, and then I'm going to completely take the wheels off and talk to you about it in a very different context, but it's an important strategic context for what we're trying to do in the DNTP. So first off, the National Toxicology Program is an interagency collaboration within the Department of Health and Human Services. The partners within that organization are NIH, and in particular NIEHS, and in most particular, my division, the division of the National Toxicology Program. And we're in partnership with CDC, and in particular, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and also the FDA, and in particular, the National Center for Toxicological Research. As a program, we have lots of partnerships both in and outside the government. And so it's a rather far-reaching organization with collaboration as a central tenet for the way that we work. We were established a little over 40 years ago with a fairly discreet mission, and that mission was to test things that people worry about, and in particular environmental chemicals, although not constrained to environmental chemicals, given our partnership with the FDA, to develop novel approaches and also to strengthen the science base, right? So have a better fundamental understanding of the kinds of things that we're characterizing. Historically, we've been a bias towards being a testing program. We have take nominations of things that are in the environment that people are concerned about. We run them through fairly traditional studies. And hopefully produce information data that are used by policymakers and regulators. And over time, we've evolved to put more effort into developing novel approaches, particularly as the challenges have grown in the area of environmental toxicology. And then increasingly trying to get a better fundamental understanding about the things that we typically characterize in the studies that we do. And then even more recently, although this dates back to about 2004, there's been a fair commitment to leading a transition or a transformation in the way that we traditionally do toxicology, largely driven by the challenge that I think Heather shared in her presentation about the rapidly growing number of chemicals and agents in our environment that we're concerned about. And so to get some fundamental better opportunity to deal with that proliferation, we need to be less of an observational science, replicating the phenotypes that we're most concerned about, and being one that is more predictive. So getting a sense of a fundamental bioactivity of agents that we're exposed to, and being able to have a sense of ultimately what the hazards are going to be or with those agents. That becomes monumentally more challenging when you're dealing with latent effects. And so that's a significant challenge that we're dealing with in the program, but fundamentally this is what drives what we do and how we do it. As a program with a long history, we've produced lots of products, and we do lots of NTP branded reports in addition to the traditional peer-reviewed kind of scientific reports. Everything we do is transparent. We generate lots of data. It's all on our websites. And so there are lots of resources out there that are available to investigators for using for in their research, and also by regulators and policymakers. So one of the first things I did was I had a vision in my head about what I thought latency was all about, but I went back to the dictionary to make sure that I was thinking about it in an appropriate way. And so I think in its broadest context, it's all about this idea that there's something present. A hazard is the something that we're interested in, and but not necessarily clinically or morphologically or phenotypically evident. And so it's sort of something smoldering in the background. And there's sort of two ways of thinking about that. One is you get exposed, and ultimately the manifestation or the manifestation of that hazard is somewhere long down the road. The other is that you've instigated a process that ultimately takes some progression to reveal itself. And the example that was in this particular dictionary was a herpes infection, and we're all familiar with either cold sores or chickenpox setting you up for the rather uncomfortable risk of shingles later in life, and I think those are two good examples. And in fact, as I think about latency, the sort of classic example I think about is in fact viral latency, which is something we're all thinking a lot about these days in the context of SARS-CoV-2 and COVID. And that's, again, I think represented by classically by HIV. So a patient is exposed, the virus infects the host cells, in this case the CD4 lymphocytes, becomes integrated into the host genome, and ultimately it may just sit there. It may sit there for years before it ultimately is recrudesced as a clinical infection. The virus starts to replicate and ultimately potentiate infection and all the systemic effects that occur with that. And in fact, this particular case, much of the therapeutic management of HIV is maintaining that latent state. So that's kind of a classic example of latency in a biological context, at least in the way that I think about it. Being a cardiovascular pathologist, the other classic way that I think about that is represented by some of the hazards associated with cancer drugs, and doxorubicin in particular. So doxorubicin is a member of a class of cancer chemotherapeutics known as anthracyclines. They're widely used in a number of both adult and childhood cancers and still widely used today. They are a key member of what are classically considered the cytotoxic chemotherapeutics, and you know that the therapeutics today are much more targeted than some of those classic cancer compounds, but these are still very traditionally used as part of cancer chemotherapy regimens. Doxorubicin or anthracyclines can induce both acute and chronic hazards or effects or toxicities. We have learned to manage many of the acute toxicities by understanding how to, one, use it in an integrated fashion with other cancer chemotherapeutics or modulate the dose. The more problematic hazards are the more chronic ones that occur in generally subsets of patients. And in particular, children, but in fact even in adults, there's a cardiotoxicity that may actually take years to manifest. And that manifestation is often in the form of cardiac insufficiency or even overt heart failures. And so to me, this is one of most undesirable consequences of disease management. And so you've got children who are successfully treated for and even cured of a childhood cancer only to develop heart failure and maybe even require a heart transplant years after the fact. That's sort of adding insult to injury. But that's another classic way I think about latency. In an environmental context, I think lead is a good example, right? So we've all come to recognize the hazards of lead exposure, and there are lots of different potential sources. And, you know, fortunately, in many more advanced societies, we've gotten smart enough to manage a lot of these challenges, particularly some of the more acute toxicities. But children in particular, either through in utero or early life exposures, in fact, are still at significant risk and have lasting neurodevelopmental effects of lead exposure that don't manifest in any clinically apparent way until you start looking very critically at the particular learning ability, IQ, all those kinds of things. And so those kinds of hazards, even long after the exposure, have long-lasting impacts on the development of those kids. And in fact, the more you look, the more we recognize that, in fact, there really are no safe levels of lead exposure for children that don't have some effect if you look closely enough. So I think lead is a good example of a latency, a hazard that may take a long time to manifest, but worse than that, have a long-lasting hazardous effect in particularly susceptible populations. Another example is represented by VES or diethyl stilbestrol. So this was a drug that was used back in the 40s, 50s, 60s as a way to manage complications of pregnancy, and ultimately was discovered not to really have any beneficial effect in that context. But unfortunately, it had a long-lasting effect, a latent effect on kids who were exposed in utero to mothers who were taking DES, and in particular some proliferative and even cancerous manifestations of that exposure later in life. And in fact, those challenges aren't the only hazards or consequences of those exposures. And in fact, there are a number of those for which there are pretty significant hazards associated with that early life exposure. Again, fortunately, this is one where we have come to understand these hazards, and that DES is used very infrequently now. But again, another example of a latent effect, and in this particular case, an indirect effect because it comes through in utero exposure to a treatment of a pregnant mother. So when you consider latency, it sort of challenges a traditional view of toxicology that was really very much based on dose and acute toxicity, and we can thank Paracelsus for some of the origins of this. But that said, I think that initial approach and focus has helped us to develop approaches that have allowed us to manage many of those most life-threatening acute toxicities. But when you consider latency as an element of all of that, that significantly complicates our ability to be able to characterize and detect some of those hazards. And so if you think about it in that context, this notion of exposure to a hazard that's continuous or discontinuous and some time span between you can actually recognize that hazard, you have to consider all of the potential contributors to that. It's not just dose. It's ultimately about the biological potency of the bioactivity, its mode of action, its fate, its biological fate in the host, the susceptibility of the host itself, and even co-exposures. And we've heard some discussions around mixtures in Heather and Seth's presentation. All of this adds considerably to the complexity of how you model these kinds of things, which is essentially what we do here in the DNTP and NTP. I think that has contributed to a significant evolution in the kind of testing that we do. And so we're not much of an LD50 kind of a field anymore. In fact, a lot of the history with the NTP is around long-term carcinogenicity testing, which is all about looking for long-term exposures and latent effects of that exposure. And in fact, we have many more types of studies that try to dig into different aspects of understanding bioactivity and consequences of that bioactivity at lots of different levels. So one of the ways that we look at latency, and particularly in a susceptible life stage, is encapsulated within our developmental repro studies. And so many of you are aware that a lot of the kinds of studies that we do, because they're intended to enable regulatory and policy making, are driven by regulatory guidelines or expectations. And in particular, our developmental repro studies have some pretty clear expectations by regulatory agencies. In this particular case, it's a global agency, the ICH, or the International Conference on Harmonization. And there are some pretty discrete expectations as it relates to modeling or assessing hazards related to development and reproduction. And in these studies are encapsulated a significant focus on the reproductive effects in the F0 generation, but also looking critically at embryo-fetal development and effects in that developing fetus and even in that postnatal life, and then even extending to understanding the potential downstream reproductive effects. So here at the in DNTP, in the National Toxicology Program, we do traditional developmental repro studies where we're looking specifically at embryo-fetal effects. But we also do a much more complex study in our modified one-generation study that looks at exposure in particular dams. And so these are pregnant dams for which the fetus is being exposed throughout their gestation. They're being exposed during lactation, and then ultimately that exposure is maintained into later life. And there are multiple PLOS of this study that are specifically focused on understanding the reproductive performance of those offspring, at looking at developmental effects and even extending out into longer-term sort of subchronic toxicity kinds of things, in addition to putting focus on some specific areas like developmental neurotox. And so, again, these are studies that have become increasingly complex in trying to understand the latent effects or consequences of in utero exposure. That has led to even longer term interest in understanding the consequences of these in utero exposures in the context of transgenerational effects. And in fact, there's growing evidence in human epidemiology studies that there may be effects to the fetus that particularly target the germ cells that might be manifest in future generations F3, F4 kinds of consequences. And so we've become interested in modeling some of those, and some of that is caught up in those modified one gen studies. Recently, within the last couple of years, one of the things that we did in our literature-based assessments, which is one of the ways that we evaluate hazards, was to look at the available evidence, particularly the epidemiology evidence, to try to find concrete support for this notion that transgenerational inheritance occurs. And in this particular context, I think illustrating the complexity of an issue like this, it was difficult to get enough evidence in any one place to be able to say that there's clear evidence that in fact this happens. But there's a lot of smoke in this space, and so there's a lot of interest in trying to model these kinds of effects. That has driven a lot of interest in what Rebecca was telling you about in the first presentation, which is epigenetics and the fact that we recognize that environmental exposures can modify epigenetic effects in biology that ultimately are heritable and things that might influence downstream kinds of consequences and effects, the hazards. And so again, this is a growing area of interest, both in us trying to mechanistically understand the hazards that we describe, but also trying to incorporate these into our standard study designs. So one area of particular interest, particularly in the context of latency, are neurodevelopmental disorders. And many of you are probably aware that there's a growing concern of what looks to be a growing incidence of neurodevelopmental effects in young children, things like attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder and autism. So again, trying to build into our traditional study designs the ability to detect these kinds of hazards brings with it challenges. So a traditional neurodevelopmental assessment in the context of our repro studies would involve the incorporation of traditional neurologic kinds of exams, which are largely focused on motor activities, locomotion, some sensory kinds of functions, those kinds of things, in addition to the typical morphologic assessments that we would do as a part of any complete morphologic tox study. That's a pretty sensitive approach and very complex. These are very complicated studies, but they're not very sensitive for the kinds of effects that we typically see in children. So it's a bit problematic to get comfortable that in fact these kinds of assessments will give you insights into the things that we're most concerned about in people. The other is that because these are so complex and large studies, you can't run them on everything. And so trying to understand which chemicals or agents you run these kinds of studies on is a challenge. And so what we've been doing is putting some focus in developing a novel pipeline that gives us a better sense of the chemicals or agents that might be inducing these kinds of things. And one approach that's been taken is to kind of break these biological pathways down into and starting to model them in integrated ways to give you some sense of, hey, look, there's bioactivity in places that might be contributing to a neurodevelopmental effect. And the other is looking at how we do our in vivo studies to be able to incorporate sensitive assessments of the kinds of things that we might think might be better representative of the kinds of behavioral disorders that we're interested in children. And so in particular, not looking at sort of contrived kind of neurobehavioral things, but looking more at natural behavior, and in fact, natural behavior in much more of a group setting, which is the way these animals are typically kept, and putting them in cages and apparatus that stimulate them to act in certain ways, and so that all that can be assessed in a much more continuous and dynamic way using computer-aided vision technologies and algorithms that are developed according to that. So this is all part of the pipeline to increase our ability to sensitively detect changes that might be reflective of these changes that we're concerned about in children. So the other area where I think is latency is a fundamental part of the assessment is within carcinogenesis. And I guess many of you are probably aware of the traditional two-year carcinogenicity bioassay. And that assay was born on, you know, our traditional and fundamental understanding of carcinogenesis and this idea that genotoxic chemicals induce DNA damage and ultimately in a context of other sort of insults that would be promoters of developing these proliferative, in fact, these uncontrolled proliferative kinds of processes, loss of endogenous control or adaptation by the host, ultimately leading to the development of malignancy. And that's the sort of the biological context for our traditional carcinogenicity assessments. Well, we've come to recognize that carcinogenesis, like most things, is much more complex than that. In fact, there are lots of bioactivities that may be contributing to the likelihood of carcinogenesis developing in a host that might not be direct, but might actually be more promoting than they are initiating. So we're taking a much broader view in how we think about carcinogenesis and trying to build those into our assessments. And in particular, as we're trying to make this transition to from an observational science to one that's more predictive, that's much more about modeling these kinds of bioactivities than it is exposing animals to long periods of time to see if, in fact, they develop a malignant tumor or not. In addition to that, again, the animal studies still have a substantive value to us as we're trying to get better or more comfortable with understanding bioactivities that would contribute to carcinogenesis. And so in recognizing that in utero exposures, early life exposures, might be a more sensitive period for even some of these bioactivities that would contribute to carcinogenesis, we've even modified our study designs for those traditional two-year studies and in fact have incorporated in utero and early life exposures as part of that chronic studies. And this is just one that was our most recent one that was published looking at PFOA, for which there's already evidence and understanding that it induces neoplastic tumors in particular rats. And in this particular case, when we incorporated the in utero exposure, in fact, there was no difference. But that was the point of the study, is to extend on our previous studies where we knew that tumors were being produced to see if in utero exposure made any difference. And in this particular case, it did not. The other way we're looking at this differently is as we get a better fundamental understanding of the molecular biology of cancers in people, is trying to bring that understanding back into our animal models. And so one part of this is recognizing that there are mutational signatures that can be characteristic of certain types of tumors. And so these are mutational signatures that we can look for in the tumors in our animal studies, which gives us an opportunity for a couple of things. One, to get some better fundamental understanding of the mechanism in which they're occurring. Gives us a better sense of being able to align the tumor and its development to the way it happens in people, which gives us some confidence in its translation. They also give us insights into some early bioactivity for which we can target our attention and ultimately try to assess in a more predictive paradigm. So, switching gears completely, so again, those are the kind of traditional ways that we incorporate an assessment of latency in our traditional testing kind of portfolio. As I mentioned to you previously, you know, we're trying to make this sort of evolution in the way that we typically do hazard assessment. And it's driven by a number of things, one of which was mentioned by Heather, and that is this idea that we've got lots of things in our environment that we should be concerned about, and the traditional approach to looking at those kinds of things, either in the context of having done the human experiment because people are exposed and we do these big epi studies to see if we see any evidence that bad things are happening, or in the rodent studies, which give us a bit better opportunity to be more proactive and protective. But those aren't very high throughput, and so that's very difficult to keep up with the rapid proliferation of these agents. And so we're having to come up with different approaches that allow us to do this much more mechanistically, much more at the cellular level, or even in lower order models that might have higher throughput but still be translationally relevant. Incorporate life stage susceptibility, so again, we get more human relevant in the way that we look at this. Having a better mechanistic understanding, actually cheaper and quicker to be able to do these things, and also the growing interest in reducing our dependence on animal use. So this is the challenge that we're currently very engaged in and trying to understand how to do this in a very, very different way, but still have the confidence to make the kinds of critical decisions that we regulators, policymakers all need to make. So one of the challenges in that is represented in here, and some of you may have seen this before. This is the diffusion of innovation graph, right? And so we all recognize that anytime there's a new approach or a new innovation, a new technology, there are folks that are just, you know, the innovators, the people who invent these novel approaches. And then there are the folks who are the early adopters, right? The risk takers who are willing to take on a novel approach and try to understand it. But the actual adoption on a large scale, the kind of large scale that it takes to be competent, to make the kinds of decisions that we make, can take a very long time, unless you're talking about the latest iPhone. But in the context of hazard assessments, this is not an easy equation. And so to strategically increase the pace at which we decrease the latency of development of a novel approach and adopt that approach for real decision making is not inconsequential. And that is something that strategically we're taking on here at the DNTP. So in summary, latency is a significant concern in hazard assessment, and you've heard good reasons to be interested in understanding latency in the context of the presentations that you've just heard. And latency is incorporated into the way that we do a traditional hazard assessments, and it's constantly being our approaches are constantly being refined to try to understand these effects better. A consequence of that is that our study designs become much more complex, which makes them harder to do, which actually plays against us in this attempt to become more predictive. When you start putting that in the human context, it gets even more complicated because of the complexity of the human condition. And so this is a real challenge in changing the way that we do this business. But ultimately, we've got to get better at mechanistically understanding the hazards that we describe and being able to predict them or extrapolate them to the human condition, because we can't possibly do it in the traditional way that we've done it in animal studies. So with that, I would like to acknowledge the great group of people that I have the privilege of working with who teach me new things every day. Having come from pharma, not an insignificant shift to be in the much more environmental toxicology world, but I appreciate their tolerance of my growth and understanding, and thank you all.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Barrage. I really appreciate that, and I just want to remind all of those of you still online, if you have any questions, please submit them through the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner, and if you have, again, any questions for any of the previous speakers, please make sure that you put their name into the question so I know who to refer the question to. So Dr. Barrage, we did get a few questions in for you. So the first one is, with this increased research, about what percentage of chemicals studied were determined to be potentially mutagenic and were previously not recognized as mutagenic?
Not previously known to be mutagenic. That's an interesting question, and I can't answer it off the top of my head. But most of the things that go into commerce today that are intended to be bioactive, the pesticides and the drugs, those kinds of things, have some fundamental hazard assessment done, and that kind of thing would absolutely be identified. The other things, food products and those kinds of things that generally aren't intended to or not expected to be hazardous, sometimes those kinds of things can escape notice. But I don't think it's common to identify something that is frankly mutagenic that wasn't recognized early in a process. Now, that said, there may be some unique metabolite of something that might ultimately become recognize that we didn't know about. I think the more problematic chemicals are the things that aren't overtly mutagenic, because I think we're all comfortable with how bad those kinds of things can be. The things that aren't mutagenic but still contribute to things like carcinogenesis, those are actually harder to deal with.
Okay, thanks. The next question is, does in utero exposure in your two-year bioassay allow you to see effects at a lower dose?
I think the potential is there. I don't know that we have, I think we have seen one experience with that. I won't go into the gory details because it's a matter of some debate. But I think potentially that is a scenario that is a concern, which is why those kinds of studies are done that way. I don't think, you know, that's a relatively new change in the way that we're doing those kinds of studies, and so I don't think our N of experience is very high. But I think that that absolutely is a theoretical potential, which is why we do those studies that way.
Okay. And the next question is, do these models assume or take into account exposures in the F0 generation are to both parents or just to one parent? In addition, do they address the time of exposure prior to mating, and do you think these components are important?
I do think those are important, and in fact, some of those transgenerational studies start to take into those kinds of considerations. And even some of the fundamental developmental repro studies will involve exposure of both the males and the females prior to mating. So bottom line is, yes, that's important. And two, in some study designs, that is incorporated.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Barrage. So please don't go anywhere because we might be getting some more questions in. So again, if you have questions for Dr. Barrage, please make sure that you add his name to the question so I know to follow up with him. But if it's okay, I'm going to go back to some of the previous speakers, and I hope that they're still on the line. So this question is for Dr. Fry. I was wondering what work you did on the epigenetic or non-genotoxic mechanisms of arsenic.
So the work that I showed in the talk is an example of work that we've done on epigenetic effects of arsenic. So that is the assessment of DNA methylation in relation to arsenic exposure. We've done that both in human populations as well as placental cells exposed in vitro. We've also done work focusing on non-coding RNAs as responders to arsenic exposure, so microRNAs in relation to prenatal arsenic exposure. Those would be several that would focus on the epigenetic effects and non-genotoxic effects.
Okay, thanks, Rebecca. So the next question would be either for Heather or Seth. What is the size of the dust particles? And I think that's kind of associated with one of the previous questions.
That's going to be for Heather. Unfortunately, she's lost her connection on the phone.
I just got back in, Seth. I'm here.
She did. Okay, great.
Yeah, it dropped me twice, and I've been able to get back in. I'm not sure if there's confusion. So we're not actually putting the dust itself into the cell cultures. We extract the dust. So we take the dust and we combine it with organic solvents and sonicate it. And then we take the solvents out and dose the cells. So the solvents, organic solvents, are evaporated off and we solvent exchange in the DMSO, and then that is spiked into the cell culture. So there's no physical dust particles in the cell cultures. It's just the chemicals that are associated with those dust particles have all been extracted and then dosed into the cells. So I hope that clarifies the question.
Okay, thanks. I hope so too. I think so. Next question is, your research suggests that exposure, this again goes to Heather and Seth, your research suggests that exposure to chemical mixtures in dust are potentially associated with thyroid hormones and BMI. What chemicals do you think may be driving these associations?
I'll take that one. So it's really hard to answer that. So my colleagues here at Duke, who are kind of experts in what we call non-targeted analysis, where you take a sample and look for everything, have performed a non-targeted analysis on dust samples. And, you know, there's just an amazing number of chemicals in house dust that we don't really think about. We've seen over 10,000 different features, which should translate to different chemicals in house dust samples. And we really only look or characterize for maybe a couple hundred of those. So there's lots of chemicals in dust, and it's always hard to say what could be driving these associations. We hypothesize that it's really an additive effect. All these different chemicals have some activity, right? And when you have so many of them together, that can potentially result in these effects. So I think what's important is to kind of characterize these different phenotypes of the dust samples moving forward, and that's something we're hoping to do. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. So the next, I think, is maybe a comment, but again, I think this goes maybe to Heather again. Define acronym of BMI long-term impacts on metabolic disorders.
Can you repeat that one more time, Sarah?
You know, I think I'm not sure I understand the comment either, so, but I'll just repeat it and define acronym of BMI long-term impacts on metabolic disorders.
Yeah, I'm not clear what the question is asking. I mean, we had one slide where we're presenting an association between triglyceride accumulation and BMI, and that was really from a cross-sectional study where we collected paired samples of house dust and then serum and attributes of participants living in those homes. So that the data in the slide I presented was really looking at the association between activity we measured in the extracts and the BMI of participants. Right, and the thought being that these represent dust samples from which the participants have been exposed for, you know, at least maybe 10 years, because we know they've lived in their homes for at least 10 years. And we know at least with flame retardants and other chemicals that these chemicals, you know, are pretty stable over time unless there's major renovations in the home. So concentrations in dust should be indicative of chronic past exposures. So we were showing the results from a cross-sectional study, so one point at time. So I hope that clarifies the question.
Okay, that's really great. We are almost out of time, and so I'm going to go ahead, and if it's okay with the organizer, the other organizers, I think we probably should close this up. But again, I want to definitely thank all the speakers. So before we conclude, let's see, make sure I'm on the right part of this. I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URL pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe for the free monthly e-newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for information on upcoming sessions, and you can also follow us on Twitter. So now I'd like to encourage everyone to join us on May 28th, June 8th, and June 16th for the next three exciting sessions in this series. The second session will focus on new methods to better understand potential disease risk by identifying key characteristics or hallmarks of chemicals and disease. This research may provide insight into identifying chemicals that may lead to disease earlier on in the disease progression and help explore how aging itself may be a risk factor for disease. If you would like to join the webinars, registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you cannot attend, archives will be made available after the events, so you can come back to these pages for links to the archives after the webinars are held. So with that, it's going to be time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and I did not have time to get to it, we will pass along your question to the presenters who can then follow up with you. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. So again, I'd really like to thank all of our presenters, Dr. Fry, Dr. Stapleton, Dr. Coleman, and Dr. Barrage, for their time in preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. And so that concludes then today's presentation. And again, I'd like to thank all almost 600 participants for being a part of today's webinar. So I'm going to sign off. Thank you.